Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the HTI-1 Proposed Rule Task Force. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and I'd like to thank you for joining us today. I'm also joined by several ONC subject matter experts who you will meet shortly. All of our task force meetings are open to the public, and your feedback is welcomed, which can be typed in the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting, or could be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled toward the end of our meeting this morning. I'd like to begin roll call of the task force members. When I call your name, please indicate if you are here. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Stephen Lane.
Good morning, I'm here.
Steve Eichner.
Good morning and welcome.
Hans Butendick.
Good morning.
Anna Galvin.
Good morning.
Audie Goon-Lopley.
Good morning.
Hi, Audie. Devin McGraw.
Good morning.
Eliel Oliveira. Bill Sullivan. And Cheryl Kearney. All right, hopefully they'll be joining us shortly. And thanks to everyone. And now please join me in welcoming Stephen Lane and Steve Eichner for their opening remarks.
Well, good morning, everybody. And again, thank you so much for joining us today, both members of the task force and members of the public who are with us today. I'm always excited to see members of the public joining us. There's some new ones today, which is wonderful. So I want to remind the members of the public that they are welcome to participate in our meeting in real time by utilizing the chat feature in Zoom. And we will be having 10 minutes set aside for verbal public comment at the end of the meeting at 11:50 Eastern time. So you are looking at our agenda for today. We are going to be focusing in today on the infeasibility exception proposal regarding uncontrollable events, as well as a new condition of third party seeking modification use, which I'm particularly interested in. We will be talking a little bit at the end about our plan for our high-tech presentation tomorrow. You know, I don't think, Mike, that we distributed to this group the slides for the high-tech presentation. Are they already posted on the public web?
Yes, I can put a link to the slides in the chat.
Great, wonderful. All right, so I think, I think we're gonna get through all of this pretty well today ready to dive in. Ike, do you wanna add anything to that?
I don't have anything to add to that wonderful introduction, other than again, echoing your welcome to members of the public and expressing gratitude both for their attendance and participation, as well as to the attendance and participation of our task force members.
Great. We invite task force members to use the hand-raising feature, and in fact, members of the public as well. If you think that you've got something that you want to share in public comment at the end, go ahead and raise your hand at any time. That will allow us to have a sense of how many comments there will be. And if we need to make more time, we'll just cut to public comment early. All right, so let's go and just review our charge briefly, especially for those who have not been here before. The charge of this task force, of which this is but one work group, is to provide recommendations back to the HITAC regarding the recent proposed rule, the HTI-1. We have a number of specific charges within there. I'm not going to read every one of them, but today our focus includes enhancing information sharing under the information blocking regulations. So we're going to be focusing on a couple of the exceptions there. On the next slide is the remainder of our charge that the task force has been working through in the three work groups. And I think we're making good progress, I must say. A lot of review has been done and some draft recommendations have been put together. I do want to remind task force members to ideally have the spreadsheet open in another screen if you can, and review as we go along and contribute to the notations there, both the recommendations as well as capturing any highlights in our discussion. Ike and the ONC team will try to capture those highlights in real time as we go along. Just as a reminder, we are on the Group 1 Recommendations tab, and today being May 16th, we are down looking at which row 6, I think, is the row that we're working on. So that's where we want to be on the spreadsheet, tab 1, row 6, capturing recommendations. Do see that Hans has already added a member recommendation for today's discussion, which we will certainly have a chance to touch on. All right, and just a reminder that the presentation to HITECH tomorrow is an interim update, giving them a sense of where we are and how far we've come, but the final recommendations will be presented in person at the HITECH meeting in DC on June 15. Hoping that many of you will be there to deliver the recommendations. Let's go to the next slide. Here again, these are the topics that were assigned to us here in Group 1, and we are focusing on the three that are highlighted regarding infeasibility, exception, and conditions. All right, next slide. Phil, thank you for joining and pointing that out. We do have from Mike the link to the presentation for tomorrow's HITECH meeting, which you're all welcome to review. We may, it'd be nice to have that ready. If we have time at the end, we might fly through that with the group just to get any final feedback. We have a comment from the public already queued up here, which we will bring up and perhaps work on even before the public comment period as needed. All right, so now we've got Cassie, Dan, and Rachel to talk us through the first of the information blocking infeasibility exception topics.
Great, thank you very much, Stephen, and thanks everybody for being here today. For those of you who have joined us previously, it's great to be with you again, and for those of you who are new, welcome. I will start out, and I know we have a limited time, so let's jump right in. Next slide, please. So this is a brief disclaimer before we jump into the rest of today's presentation and discussion. I would just note that the materials contained in this document are based on the proposals in the Health Data, Technology, and Interoperability Certification Program Updates, Algorithm Transparency and Information Sharing Proposed Rule, also known as HTI-1. While every effort has been made to ensure the accuracy of this restatement of those proposals, this document is not a legal document, and the official proposals are in the proposed rule. Please also note that other federal, state, and local laws may also apply. Another note, ONC must protect the rulemaking process and comply with the Administrative Procedure Act. During the rulemaking process, ONC can only present the information that's in the proposed rule as it's contained in the proposed rule. ONC cannot interpret that information or clarify or provide further guidance. And this communication is produced and disseminated at U.S. taxpayer expense. Next slide, please. Okay, so here we have our agenda for the discussion today. And as noted, what we're here to discuss are two elements of the information blocking infeasibility exception. First, revising the existing condition of the infeasibility exception that involves uncontrollable events. And second, the proposed new condition, third party seeking modification use. So I'll be going over the first several slides during our presentation today, providing some context and background and overview of the policies. And then I will turn it over to my colleague, Cassie Weaver, and to continue the presentation and discussion. Next slide, please. So again, we'll start out with some background and context here. Next slide, please. So as we mentioned, these are the two proposals we're going to be discussing. First, ONC proposes to revise the uncontrollable events condition of the infeasibility exception to information blocking in part 171.204A1. And then second, ONC proposes to renumber the infeasibility conditions infeasible under the circumstances condition from paragraph A3 to A5, and to codify at A3 a new condition that we're also set to discuss here, third-party seeking modification use. Next slide, please. Okay, so first we'll start out with some background on the first topic of discussion, revising the existing condition relating to uncontrollable events. So to begin, we created an exception under which an actor's practice of not fulfilling a request to access, exchange, or use EHI, quote unquote, due to the infeasibility of the request would not be considered information blocking. And in the preamble of the Cures Act final rule, we specified that there may be situations when complying with the request for access, exchange, or use of EHI would be considered infeasible because an actor is unable to provide such access, exchange, or use due to unforeseeable or unavoidable circumstances that are outside of the actor's control. As examples, we noted that an actor could seek coverage under the infeasibility exception if it was able to provide access, exchange, or use of EHI, provide access, exchange, or use due to a natural disaster or war. Importantly, we noted that the actor would need to produce evidence and ultimately prove that complying with the request for access, exchange, or use of EHI in the manner requested would have imposed a clearly unreasonable burden on the actor under the circumstances. And we have citations, if folks are interested, to the places in the rule preamble where these discussions take place. In addition, as part of the revisions to add clarity to the infeasibility exception in the Cures Act final rule, we established the standalone uncontrollable events condition of that exception. And under the uncontrollable events condition, an actor's practice of not fulfilling a request to access, exchange, or use EHI as a result of a natural or human-made disaster, a public health emergency, public safety incident, and the other categories that one can see here, will not be considered information blocking, provided that such practice also meets the relevant condition contained in the regulations. Next slide, please. So as to some additional context around this uncontrollable events condition, the fact that an uncontrollable event that was specified in the regulation occurred is not a sufficient basis alone for an actor to meet the uncontrollable events condition of the infeasibility exception. Instead, the use of the words due to, as we noted, in that condition was intended to convey, consistent with the proposed rule, and does convey that the actor must demonstrate a causal connection between not providing access, exchange, or use of EHI and the uncontrollable event. So to illustrate, a public health emergency was listed as an uncontrollable event in the regulation. So if the federal government or a state government were to declare a public health emergency, the mere fact of the declaration would not suffice for the actor to meet the condition. To meet the condition, the actor would need to demonstrate that the public health emergency actually caused the actor to be unable to provide access, exchange, or use of EHI for the facts, specific facts and circumstances in question. One additional note on that, the emergency need not be the only cause of a particular incapacity, but the actor needs to demonstrate that the public health emergency did in fact negatively impact the feasibility of that actor fulfilling access, exchange, or use in those specific circumstances where the actor is claiming infeasibility. Just to provide some additional context there on this first condition that we're discussing today. Next slide, please. Okay, and here we get into the background on our second topic of discussion today, the new condition of third party seeking modification use. So here I'm going to turn the mic over to my colleague Cassie Weaver to continue on with this portion of our presentation today. So Cassie, I will turn it over to you.
Thanks so much, Dan. I appreciate that. So I'm going to dig into this new proposed condition for the infeasibility exception in just a minute. But first, I want to walk through this slide so that we're all kind of clear what we're talking about. So here you can see in black the current infeasibility exception and the current conditions. So we're starting with B because it applies to all of the conditions in this infeasibility exception as it stands today. So you have to meet the requirements in B and all of the requirements and at least one of the conditions from paragraph A. So there's no change to paragraph B. We are changing things, however, in paragraph A. So as Dan just discussed, we're proposing one change that's really more of a clarification to A1. A2, the segmentation doesn't have any changes proposed. And then A3, we are proposing to redesignate at A5, but we are not proposing any changes to the substance of that condition. And so then in between, obviously, we have a new A4 and a new A5 that we're proposing. One of those is the manner exception exhausted condition, which we'll either talk about next week or already covered. Now I can't remember. I think we'll talk about next week. And then the other is this third party seeking modification use condition, which is what I'm going to get into here in just a minute. But before I do, I just want to remind folks what infeasible under the circumstances currently requires. Because right now, to meet that infeasible under the circumstances condition, an actor has to, oh, thanks, Stephen Lane. Okay, so yes, we will discuss the manner exception exhausted condition next week. Today, to meet the infeasible under the circumstances condition, an actor has to demonstrate six separate factors that led to its determination that complying with the request would be infeasible under the circumstances. So those factors, just quickly summarized, again, refer to the reg text. This isn't the actual reg text, are the type of EHI and the purpose for which it would be used, the cost to the actor, the financial and technical resources available to the actor. It has to be a non-discriminatory practice. The actor must consider if it has predominant control over the relevant technology and also demonstrate why the actor was unable to provide the EHI in an alternative manner, which those alternative manners are the ones listed in that in our current content and manner exception. So just kind of keep that in mind as we go forward here because it's relevant as to why we propose the two new conditions. So next slide, please. So this background for this third party seeking modification use, I'll get into the details of it again in a few minutes. So just bear with me while I talk about why we're proposing it. Basically we're looking to reduce actor burden and uncertainty by creating this condition whereby practices specific to declining certain requests for third party modification use of EHI that's held by or for a healthcare provider could be accepted from information blocking more efficiently than might be the case under those other conditions in the infeasibility exception or under other exceptions. So in these instances, you know, an actor may be concerned about the accuracy or reliability of data that a third party would like to add to an individual's designated record set maintained by the actor. Or an actor may be unable to complete a third party's request to modify or add EHI in the specific way that it was requested. So then, rather than working through all of the alternative manners or establishing that the practice meets the security exception or working through all those six factors of the feasibility exception, we propose that this third party seeking modification use would apply in certain situations where the actor is asked to provide the ability for a third party or for its technology, such as an application, to modify EHI that is maintained by or for an entity that has certified health information technology and maintains within that technology any electronic health information as defined in our regulations. So we also propose that the request to enable use of EHI in order to modify it be limited so that it does not apply when the request is from a healthcare provider requesting such use from an actor that is its business associate, which I will also explain more as we go on. Next slide, please. So some more context for this third party seeking modification use. It is available where the actor is asked to provide the ability, I just said this on the previous one, but for a third party or its technology, such as an application, to modify EHI that is maintained by or for the entity that has deployed the health IT as defined in 170.102 and maintains within or through use of that technology any instances of any EHI as defined in the information blocking regs at 171.102. It's not available when the request is from a healthcare provider requesting directly or through another business associate of that same healthcare provider that modification use from an actor that is its business associate. Next slide, please. All right, so let's get into these actual proposed revisions and new conditions. First, next slide. The uncontrollable events proposed update, which Dan really covered most of this already, but again, here we're proposing to revise this condition by replacing due to with because of, to make clear that a causal connection is needed to use this exception. In our view, this really isn't a substantive change. It's more of a correction and conforms to the preamble, not just in this proposed rule, but also in that CARES Act final rule. We want this exception to be used in situations where it is really needed. It makes clear that this actor, that the actor has to demonstrate the causal connection, not just state that it exists. Just the fact that an uncontrollable event specified occurred is not a sufficient basis alone. Next slide, please. And here is the new reg text for this. Again, the only change here is in the text that says due to, we have changed to because of a natural or human-made disaster, and then an ongoing list with the rest of the uncontrollable events. Next slide. And now the third party seeking modification use proposed update. Again, here, this is to reduce actor burden and uncertainty. It will allow an actor to turn down without information blocking a request to enable one or more third parties to modify EHI, which includes but isn't limited to creation and deletion functionality. And it could be considered infeasible, but this exception isn't available if the request is from a healthcare provider requesting such use from an actor that is its business associate. Again, this just has less documentation requirements compared to those six factors and infeasible under the circumstances. There's no need to look to see if another exception applies to the request, such as the security exception. So if you are an actor who has security concerns, but the practice would otherwise meet these conditions, you can meet this condition of the infeasibility exception rather than the slightly more onerous requirements of the security exception. I want to emphasize here that where this condition of this exception is not applicable, all the other conditions of the infeasibility exception are still applicable, including the infeasible under the circumstances condition, and every other exception in the information blocking regulations is still available. So just because you are unable to meet this condition does not mean that you are unable to meet some other condition or exception. Next slide, please. And here's the proposed text for A3. An actor's practice will not be considered information blocking due to the infeasibility of the request when the request is to enable use of EHI in order to modify EHI, including but not limited to creation and deletion functionality, provided the request is not from a healthcare provider requesting such use from an actor that is its business associate. And if you look at the preamble, we go through the way that we are using the word use here in order to get to this modification use. I recommend you read all of the preamble, but if you're wondering about that, please do take a look there. And then I see some comments and questions are already coming in. I think our next slide will say discussion on it, but maybe we should leave it here because it might help us to be able to look at this for some of these questions. Let's see. Does modification of EHI include the ability to add new instances of data elements or only to modify data that has previously been entered? Correcting an erroneous entry or modifying a medication dosage for an existing medication. I don't believe in the preamble that we get into that specificity about the actual data. I can tell you that we do say that by use here encompasses the ability to read, write, modify, manipulate, or apply. So use would cover all of those. And it does focus on, in particular, this condition focuses on requests to create and delete EHI held by or for a healthcare provider. So I think that if you apply that to that question, it would not just be modify in that sense, but modification use would be adding as well.
Yeah, I just want to confirm that too. What Cassie said, like create is the same as adding something because you're creating something in the record. So you're adding something to the record. So it covers all those.
Okay. And then the next question does, I like that abbreviation, TPSMU, third party seeking modification use include a provider requesting that their business associate EHR allow a specified app to add data to or modify data already existing. So this exception specifically excludes business associates of any actor, which doesn't mean that the provider has to allow it to occur. It just means if the provider doesn't want to allow the business associate to add data, then they need to seek another exception.
Yeah,
or just have a practice that isn't information blocking. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, add a little more to that. So So we made it pretty clear here. It says business associate. We adopt the same definition of a business associate as HIPAA does for purposes of this. This isn't changing anything with what the status quo. So the bigger picture status quo prior to this proposal is all requests of use are in scope for information blocking by all entities. And so then it does an exception apply in all those circumstances. What normally would have to occur is let's just use the EHR vendor as the best example, in which we do use the EHR vendor in the preamble too, as an example. They would either have to meet the request or use an exception why they didn't. So either the infeasibility under circumstances, which Cassie alluded to, is a six factor test, and there are certain things you can't consider too, which is like competition, how much you make, what your profit would be. There's also, you know, other exceptions that could apply, privacy, security. So, you know, that's the current landscape. But then when you look at all the situations, what we're saying is anyone who isn't a business associate of the healthcare provider, then this, who's asking to do this, what would you say, modification use, then you can use this exception. You don't have to go through all the other exceptions. When it comes to a business associate of a healthcare provider, all business associate agreements have to comply with the requirements under HIPAA too. So they have preconditions. So we have a privacy exception, right? Preconditions of how they determine what the use, access use of that business associate is going to be. This isn't changing any of that. But if one of them was that I need you as a CDS, let's say a clinical distance support app, need you to write to the record. This condition could not be used if that app, that the healthcare provider or the app acting on behalf of the healthcare provider, as we say in the preamble, asks to write to the record to the EHR developer maintained as a business associate. Can't use this exception that we're proposing, but there's still all the other exceptions. So we haven't changed anything in that respect. Still the same dynamic exists in that existed prior to this proposal. So that hopefully provides some clarity, but obviously we can take additional questions on that.
Why don't I go ahead and just verbalize my question, because I've really been struggling with this. I'm trying to figure out whether this change provides the opening that providers have wanted to be able to use apps to write data into their EHR database. I mean, that for me, that is the core question. I appreciate that the EHRs could try to dodge, you know, this responsibility using any number of other exceptions. But, you know, what I'm hoping this will do is help to open the door to write access to the EHR data, which EHRs have largely been blocking forever. So one question about this business associate issue is if I'm a provider and I develop an app in-house that wants to write to the EHR database, is that different than if I'm a provider and I purchase an app from an app developer, you know, who then, you know, presumably would be my business associate? Does that purchasing the app from a business associate change my ability to claim that I want to utilize that app to, quote, use my EHI that's maintained in my EHR? Or, you know, so is there a bright line between in-house developed apps and purchased apps? Let's start with that question.
No. I mean, the whole basis, and we recite some of this in the preamble for this proposal, has not changed why we did the original Cures Act rule and final rule, including saying that we weren't going to permit business associate agreements to be an exception by themselves under the rules. I don't know how much, so it covered right, you know, right as some people understand right to be. I understand there's a difference of opinion what right means in a technical sense comparatively, but it was always in scope of the definition of use. That hasn't changed. What we're saying is part of that scope, which is modifying a record or adding to a record, do anything to change the record or add information to the record. We're saying in this particular scenario where the entity that is requesting it, which could be a healthcare provider on that's not affiliated with the other healthcare provider that's an actor or an EHR company who's a business associate of the actor, that situation, third-party apps, patient-facing apps, any other outside party, a public health agency who wanted to somehow write back to the record with immunization data, let's just, all those are no-go under this exception for that actor. That's the proposal.
If they want to use it.
if they want to use it. They don't have
it's
to do
voluntary.
It.
It's voluntary, right? They right. don't
like,
have to do it.
They could do that. They could let the writing happen to the record, right? In the context of everything they're under laws, right? Under applicable laws, they can do all that
the
stuff.
Blood pressure and right.
If they didn't want to, this would be available to them in those circumstances, if it was finalized as is. Prior to this, all those entities I just mentioned, plus business associates of the healthcare provider, were all similarly situated. So all of that, if I was the entity who was being asked to have information written to the record, I would have to use a different exception as to why, if I did not want to allow that to happen. So I would have to use the infeasibility under circumstances, or I'd have to use a security one, or potentially a privacy exception. So all we're doing is carving out that particular set of requests and from certain entities. But the other piece, which is what we've always been trying to address, that in the congressional report to Congress, we mentioned it in the preamble of the proposed rule, and all this is mentioned again in this proposed rule, preamble of the Cures Act proposed rule. We recite all that again in this rule. That hasn't changed. That is what we've heard. That's what Congress heard as a concern, is certain, you know, EHR vendors or maybe even healthcare systems were not permitting, you know, generally the one example use case is the one I've given you, and it could be for population analytics. It could be for a lot of different reasons. A healthcare system wants to use a different vendor, different app to write to the record. And they were having difficulty doing that with their EHR vendor. So that hasn't changed. We were trying to address that with the Cures rule, and that's still, and that's why, if anything, that's why we said that. We're not carving out that situation or not including that situation in this proposed exception. But again, you know, the BAA agreements decide the scope of each business associate's access to the record in the first place. So I think that's almost essentially like a precondition before you would even get yourself to an information blocking stage, is that other business associate in their business associate agreement, that would have to even be written in there in the first place, that they have, you know, on behalf of the healthcare entity, the ability to write to the record. So so it shouldn't be overinterpreted that any business associate that they have, even previously, had some, you know, ability to write to the record under info blocking.
So Michael, so I think you're saying, again, I'm really trying to understand, and I can't,
sure.
I'm trying to listen to you really carefully, so I haven't been able to follow that, which I think there's some brilliant people putting great thoughts there, which I'll have to get back to. But does this change make things better or worse for providers who want to use apps to write to their EHR database? When I first read it, I thought it made it better. And based on what you just said, I think it makes it worse. And that's what I'm trying to understand.
Well, I am not going to opine in that way on the provision.
Can you do harder or easier, Mike?
Yeah, right. Not either, Mike.
Harder or easier? I'm sorry.
I think it is designed to address a certain situation, which we've heard from actors under the rule, that they've had difficulty.
Provider actors or EHR vendor actors?
I think both we've actually heard it from, because don't forget, the EHR vendor is a business associate of a provider.
Exactly.
Right. So I think we've heard it from both, and to provide them more certainty that, you know, we did not think in that situation, you know, certainty can be provided in other ways. You know, I'm saying something that's public. It's in the budget request for advisory opinions. So that's another way to do certain situations. And you can actually apply the facts to them in that case. And you can look at intent, and you can actually give a better guidance on the situation. But here we think that based on these facts, as we've laid them out in the preamble, we're providing a potential exception. So I'm not going to say it's harder, easier, or better, or worse. I don't think it's changed the situation at all for what I think you're asking about, which is a healthcare provider being able to use another business associate to write to the record. I don't think that's changed. This my colleagues can weigh into, but we were very careful in how we crafted this to not change that situation. I think it's status quo, really, I would say, for that situation would be the way I would characterize it.
But it also doesn't change the ability of the provider actor to use their own in-house developed app to do the same thing. What you're saying is the EHR vendor could write into their BAA, which is a requirement of their sale of their EHR, that they're just not going to allow write access.
Right. And what we said in our rule about that is that we have a whole in the final rule of the Cures Act final rule, it was called. We talked about that situation about a business associate agreement, and that we would look at that because they said sometimes there's uneven bargaining positions by both the developer and the potentially, it's not just the provider who's the one initiating the BAA, and that we would, those would be open for OIG to investigate to determine whether or not the terms are an interference themselves. So that's still status quo too. That hasn't changed. There just hasn't been obviously any investigation and enforcement yet into these, but the policy related to that hasn't changed.
Okay. If no one else is going to raise their hand, I'm going to keep asking questions until I understand this.
Can I just add one thing, and kind of based on some of the chat, which is that we have previously issued an FAQ that said that provisions in a business associate agreement could implicate the information blocking regulations. So
yeah, that was the example. I was trying to get to. And I'm sorry if I did not provide a clarity, Cassie just did, but that's what we said. The business associates agreements themselves are not some type of exception or bar to a potential information blocking claim, and that we said there could be unequal bargaining power, and therefore the terms themselves are subject to investigation as to why those terms were reached that could be an interference under the information blocking. So that was to your question, Stephen, about them putting an EHR vendor putting certain provisions in their contract. And it will obviously be very fact specific because it depends on what type of access you're saying. Is it an API access? Is it a proprietary API? Is it a certified API? All of that comes into play. But generally speaking, they're all within scope for investigation under the policies. So okay. I see there's a lot more hands. So
yeah, thank you for humoring me. Ike, your hand is up next.
Thanks so much. I can see this is a really complex issue. One thing I think that we may want to explore making a recommendation about is looking at refining the language about not just a business associate, but within the scope of the business associate agreement, so that there's a bound in that space. I guess the other issue there is looking at unintended consequences of looking at modifying a record that may have other effects on the functioning of the EHR, not from a pure data perspective, but looking at modifying a data table or modifying a structure that may then result in the EHR not being able to function because a field got relabeled or some other condition that was a result of that data insertion, and just kind of wondering how do we best address that kind of scenario. So I'm not sure there's a question there, but I do think at least including the refinement about the business associate agreement and the scope of the exception being tied to the nature of agreement is at least a minimal thing we can do. And I entered that as some text in the worksheet.
Thanks.
Right. So Stephen, what I'm hearing from you is, and that's is something like, and I don't want to, so that you can obviously respond if I mischaracterize what I'm hearing from you, but I'm going to try to do an analogy for folks. Like segmentation, right? We have a segmentation exception by itself, which says if you can unambiguously segment part of the record, then you can get, it's infeasible. And I think what you are raising is it even feasible to write to the record? And I think it's going to be circumstantial. So but I think you're giving an example where you think maybe it wouldn't be because of all the potential problems that could occur, which I think we acknowledge that, and but we don't specifically offer a condition under feasibility about right. that generally.
I don't
for the reasons we discussed. But,
right, and yeah. here's where I perceive to be a rub is that I think it is feasible to write to the record. The challenge is looking at modifying the record in a way that doesn't have any unintended downstream effects. So it's again hitting that balance
point. Right.
Great to do it, but if you suddenly inserted a unexpected value into the data set behind the scenes and the software that was normally accessing the data was expecting values in certain ranges and was doing error checking on the right. input side of it, suddenly you're ending up with weird data coming out.
Yeah. And so this proposed condition of the exception would address any potential of that happening from anybody who wasn't a business associate. Now, when it comes to a business associate of the healthcare entity, that could probably still happen, Stephen. I'm not going to say it couldn't, but you know, it's approached differently under info blocking. But for anybody else trying to do that, that would not be a concern under this new
right,
yeah, condition. Yeah.
Right, okay. Right, exactly. But again, mm-hmm. thinking of that as a kind of a case and again, thinking it perhaps from a language in terms of looking at any investigation in that space as a subsequent action would say, hey, you know, this is a consideration here. Mm-hmm. Might be an approach. Again, I really want to encourage, I think it's important to provide the ability to write access to the data so that you can have a unified patient record. That part makes a great deal of sense to me. It's just not having an unintended consequence on software performance is the other end of it that we've got to figure out some way of balancing against.
One thing we do mention in the preamble too is that, you know, again, where this doesn't seem to quite fit a given scenario, that there is the health IT performance exception, there is the security exception. I know that's not necessarily satisfactory for each set of facts or circumstances, but sometimes it helps to keep that in mind. Devin, I see you have had your
yes,
hand up patiently for a while.
yes, Devin, go right ahead.
No, that's okay. No, I mean, no worries. This is a lot of discussion on this and it's been very interesting. I found this exception a little bit hard to wrap my brain around because as always, the double negative stuff really gets to you, right? It's not information blocking, except when it's not level. But I am going to raise something that that Mel Solis raised in her comments. It's something that she talked about on another on an interoperability matters call that I was on, and I think it's an important point because the definition of healthcare provider in as an actor extends beyond those providers that are subject to HIPAA, because HIPAA is only those providers who bill electronically. So you're going to have some providers who are contracting. And it, with data holders, like an EHR provider, for example, that is not their business associate because they're not business associates because they're not HIPAA covered. So just wondering if ONC has any reaction to a potential comment from us that this be extended to contractors that are data holders that are not business associates because they're working for providers that themselves are not covered entities.
I think that's a good comment. I think it, you know, I won't go into too much because, you know, deliberate process, but you, yeah, I think that's a good comment. I think you should make that comment. I think we were looking at that in another exception too. I do say that, you know, we also have to consider from the whole scope of all of it too. And we are, and we did get comments on, you know, should it have been limited? That definition, should we have limited it just to HIPAA? And obviously we chose not to, we just went with the statutory definition. But there still has to be, we have to look at, when I say the whole big picture, it's also investigation enforcement as well. So, you know, that's a consideration for the department too, what our abilities will be in that space as well. So, but yeah, that's a good comment. So thank you.
I think we're mostly caught up in chat, but if someone from the task force does have a question in the chat that they feel wasn't answered, feel free to ask it again verbally now so we can try to get to it.
I know you've been monitoring the chat more closely than I've been able to, because I can't do that and listen carefully at the same time. Was there anything else in chat that you thought needed to be raised, either from panelists or members of the public?
I've been tracking, and I think we've picked up everything.
Okay, I want to try to capture the insights that have been developed here through our discussion in this column I. And I tried to write down what I came away with, but I invite others, Devin, you in particular, to sort of jump in and add text here so that we can at least try to capture what we've discussed. I'll also point out to task force members that we have said that we want to use column I in the spreadsheet to capture the names of SMEs that we'll be inviting to future meetings, and the ONC team as well. You guys have been capturing a number of SMEs for some other work group discussions. And if we can kind of keep a listing of those in the spreadsheet, that would be really, really helpful, I think, for all to know where to go to reference that. All right. Phil, your hand is up.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. I'm curious on on the scenario where if there's a write request to the EHR, but the EHR has not developed the API ability to receive programmatic write requests, what does that fall under if there's simply no ability that's been developed to write into the EHR? Like, the regulation requires the ability that for the EHR to allow read access to all of the data, but there's not a specific requirement to provide write.
Right. So you're talking about the certified EHR or API. Obviously, a lot of vendors have proprietary APIs that do and maybe not have write access. But again, you'd be in the infeasibility under circumstances, potentially, right? So that looks at what resources you have. If you don't, because that one looks at if you could build an interface like based on the request, right? So our other, you should try to consider some of your comments and your thoughts in conjunction with other proposals. So we also have the Manner Exhausted proposal too now. So
which we haven't presented yet,
though. Yeah, haven't presented on yet, but that kind of looks at what your functionality is you're providing as a developer. But the infeasibility under circumstance would be the one, generally I would be thinking in that situation. But again, keep that thought in mind also with the new proposed manner exhaustion condition that will be discussed at a later date.
Okay.
I am hoping that someone is writing in this field here. It looks like some people have their cursors in there. I'm still trying to digest all the great thoughts in the chat here. Devin, are you writing, or can you sort of summarize and I'll write the insights that you've developed here?
No, I mean, I'd be happy to. I don't find I do it as effectively while I'm simultaneously also trying to listen.
Yeah, right.
I do remember the issues on which I'm sort of being kind of at least those I'm actively engaged on. And when I go to do my homework, I'll put it in.
Wonderful. Right. Yeah, I do see that somebody added, I think the answer to Phil's question, or somebody added the question, Phil's question, which is, when the EHR does not have right access, does the infeasibility exception apply? And it sounds like either infeasibility or and potentially infeasibility under the circumstances. Does that's what I think I heard there. Cassie, you've got a poker face on.
That's good. Mike's always telling me that I'm smirking, so I'm glad I have a poker face. yeah, I think I would repeat my line that the other exceptions are available, including the other conditions of the infeasibility exception. And if something can't be done, then it would be probably infeasible. If you looked at the exceptions, you could probably find one, or the conditions rather.
Okay. As you and I shared a bit in the chat, Cassie, I think, you know, I'll just restate that my enthusiasm when I first saw this was that I thought that this actually provided benefit to providers who wanted to force their EHR vendors to allow them to write to the record, the old fire write access. And, you know, at the end of this discussion, my sense is that that's not the case, that if anything, this actually was a gimme to the vendors who were trying to find ways to avoid providing that functionality. And if I've got that wrong, please disabuse me of that opinion.
Blink twice. No, just kidding.
So, Stephen, without endorsing your characterizations of it, I think that is a fairly accurate understanding in terms of the proposal.
Great, thank you. I will stop celebrating.
but I do want to say about the, you know, I don't want to lose sight of, you know, why what exists today and. The point you raise, and I don't want to belabor it, but you know, there's information out there, both studies, surveys, and general feedback, specific feedback from even our questions from Congress, from constituents about this particular situation we're still hearing about. So I'll just leave it at that this particular situation, we still receive questions and comments about and concerns from various avenues.
Ike, your hand is up.
This is actually a question for you, Stephen. I wonder if there's an opportunity to make a recommendation in the space, perhaps not in this particular rule, but looking forward, if there's a way to advance your goal of improving provider access in a manner that is compatible or supported by APIs in that space to facilitate that kind of access as part of perhaps a longer range increased requirement on EHRs to help alleviate, to both help provide providers access or right access, but also help alleviate concerns about breaking or impacting the data behind the scenes, as it were.
Good point. I want to apologize to the members of the public. I said in this meeting, and I've said in prior meetings of this task force, that there was an open invitation to raise your hand during the course of the meeting so that we could keep account of the number of public comments that we were going to need to process. And apparently the ONC and Excel has another opinion. They would rather wait and have people raise their hands all at once at 10 minutes before the end. So my apologies for giving the wrong instructions. Having said that, we are half an hour before the end, and we seem to have exhausted our discussion here. Yeah, Hans, you're saved the day.
The reason that I waited for the hand off is that with the discussion so far, it has been focused very much on the specific proposals and updates, where did not have a lot of specific feedback on. It was very clear. In some areas, like a good point raised on between the relationship where there's a BAA and where there's a contract, I think that's a very helpful question to get further clarification on. But otherwise, the proposals provided with because of and et cetera, were very clear on the last topic. In the end, I'm not sure whether the updates and the clarification on not just focusing on the BAA part, whether that really fundamentally changes the arguments and the rationale and the evidence that needs to be provided, whether you can or cannot provide rights. So I'm not at the same page as that it's a favors one over the other. There's still the fundamental questions on why something can or cannot be done still remains the same. There's some clarity in some areas, but beyond that, not sure how much it changes what was already there. The reason that I waited is that there's another question around feasibility that was not brought up, but that there is continued question and concern around. So it would not be a reaction to a specific proposal, but currently how exceptions, and particularly when infeasibility comes into play, where you typically are more complex scenarios, alternatives that need to be evaluated, that you may need to do in combination with other considerations, other exceptions, as well as that if you receive one request first, at some point in time, you're going to get a similar, if not the same, request later. For example, some updates that need to be would be requested for updates to data, like we talked about. The 10 days is challenging because that's an overall approach, and you need the time in order to go through the considerations, why things can or cannot be done, under what context and whatnot. So the 10 days response time from the moment that you receive the request, rather than from a point where the evaluation or the information and the understanding of what is being asked for has been sufficiently worked through, that's remaining a challenge, where we see that how do we do that in 10 days when things get more complex. So that's where we would have a consideration of consider it based on a time that the evaluation is collectively done with the requester, and that then goes back to the circumstances, the facts, the intent, to address whether the time spent on it was inappropriately long or whether it was appropriately correct because of the complexity of the issue. So that's where, in the context of infeasibility, we remain to have some concerns. And would like to recommend that time window is not starting at the time of the request, but at this time of a mutually acceptable way to go through the review, the evaluation, so that then it can be informed at that point in time and to finalize the response.
So Hans, thank you for that. And before we go to the raised hands, I guess I would just ask if the work group would like to embrace Hans' recommendation.
No. No.
Okay, perfect. Devin, go.
That's very clear.
And your hand is up, Devin.
Go right ahead. That's why my hand is up. It's wet, you know, I appreciate that 10 days may be too short. So I'm not necessarily disagreeing that feels a little cramped, but if we're going to extend it, I think we should seriously think about where there still needs to be a deadline, because I think otherwise requesters with legitimate requests could be left on the back burner indefinitely without some sort of expected time frame.
And I completely appreciate your concern, Devin. It's one of those 10 is too short, there is too long, what's a reasonable way that works and that you can get a good response from everybody and it's satisfactory. So I have no concerns with your concern that there needs to be a backboard, but the 10 days is short.
So it's not a full disagreement. It's a we still need an outer boundary.
I need to be clarity there, but yeah. Is across the variety of exceptions when it gets complex is that's unattainable.
Yeah.
Mike?
Yeah, I was going to actually comment on that too. So I appreciate that, Devin and Hans, your points. So what we've committed to as an agency, not within a particular period of time, but we're working on it, is, you know, when do you actually have an actionable, this isn't necessarily the term of art yet, but an actionable request that you know you have something of which you can act upon to attempt to respond. So that's one thing. And then that would probably indicate when, for example, in certain circumstances, the quote unquote 10 days starts. The other piece that I would note about that, there was a discussion, you know, because this is not the first time someone has raised the issue of 10 days. It was raised in the proposal, in comments on the proposal originally, and we responded and kept it at 10, noting that, you know, also in our discussion with the OIG, that they would, you know, it is an intent-based statute as well, right? And this is an exception. It's really essentially trying to find, you know, a safe harbor as to your actions and why, even though you didn't do something, that you did commit an interference, that you did, you know, have bad intent, or maybe not bad intent, but you still met an exception. Wouldn't really matter your intent in that example. So I just wanted to keep that in mind. Like it's not something that wasn't raised in the proposed rule that we addressed then. We continue to appreciate the comments. I do think some of it is contingent on knowing when you have something that's actionable that starts the clock. And so we are looking at that too. So thank you for that time.
Okay, others on the work group want to chime in on this? Ike, so you had some recommendations as well, in addition to Hans, regarding the 10 days. Do you want to comment on those?
If that was to be no, I don't have any recommendation looking at 10 day.
No. I said, you have a couple of recommendations that you put in column G.
Yes.
ONC consider revising the draft rule to reference any disaster emergency declared by the appropriate governmental entity. This could include public health emergencies, but would also include response, recovery periods associated with natural disasters that impacted the availability of providers' information systems or data.
Right. Again, just to elaborate that, you know, in the sense of a hurricane or other natural event that's not necessarily specifically a public health disaster, that would definitely have may very well have an impact on a provider's ability to respond to an information request. If they've got no electricity to their system, they cannot respond unless they've got a backup that's outside of the affected area. And obviously that disaster could also include a public health disaster, but I think that's perhaps a little more accurate in terms of looking at the impact. Again, in the same situation, that just because there's a natural disaster or publicly declared disaster doesn't mean automatically that there might be an exception, but it provides perhaps a better basis.
Anyone feel that they would like to either support or conflict with that recommendation? Because this is what we want to do, is we want to bring recommendations together here that we will then include in the in our report to the HITECH. That does not seem unreasonable, Ike.
And I guess question for our ONC representatives and presenters is there, without the modification to the rule, what would happen, what available exception might apply to a healthcare provider in the situation that I just described, that they were provider in, say, Tampa, Florida, and hurricane comes through and they've got no power for 3 weeks.
So that's covered. We I don't know if maybe the team while I'm talking, somebody can quickly bring up the reg text. Although I can't remember, maybe it's not in reg text, Rachel, that we describe an uncontrollable event. Can't remember, or if it's only in preamble. But it's war. It is natural disasters, which would be a hurricane of. You just have to show that it's because of. So in the example you're giving, it is because of the hurricane knocked out all our electricity, so we cannot respond. It was just that what we were getting questions on, and we still feel that as drafted, it was clear enough from if you were an enforcement perspective, but we are in here doing changes in feasibility. So we felt like we had enough comments to address it. But the main, what came to us is, COVID-19, public health emergency. That's an uncontrollable, we don't have to respond. And what we said, it's due to in the rule currently in the reg text. And so that was to say that it should have been it's a causal connection. That may be true. Maybe you have an influx of patients, right? In such and such hospital, because there were waves at different parts of the country. Absolutely. Right? And so you could not respond because of COVID-19, but it wasn't a blanket. Everybody didn't have to respond because of COVID-19, public health emergency was the point we were trying to make. That exception didn't provide that. So you, to your point, we can go through tons of examples. The hurricane comes through, knocks out all your power, but doesn't knock out the neighbor down the street. So two different facts and circumstances. So while you could use this provision, they may not be able to use it because it didn't prevent them from responding. Does that make sense?
Okay. Exactly.
And that's how it is.
And that's exactly my point. Where I guess I was going overall is having it, if we adopt this language, it then seems like there are two very similar exceptions that could be potentially be confusing for the provider community. And if there's a singular exception that would encompass both, that would seem to me to be a more logical approach. Does that make sense?
I guess I'll speak for Onsi, and none of my colleagues have jumped in. I was hoping the reg text we could get up just so you can see it again and understand what the change was. I feel contextually everybody.
Rachel's been trying to paste text into chat, but I think bringing it up is a good idea.
I could probably get to
this. It is in the PowerPoint.
Let me go to
the new proposed text anyway.
Why don't we pop back to the PowerPoint? We're going to be cutting to public comment fairly soon here.
And it may be just a misunderstanding on my part.
Yeah, so I could share my screen if that's feasible. I don't know if it is for folks. Can I do that? I'm not sure. I guess I could try and see what happens, right? Let me try to do that. Up there. All right, perfect. I can.
I think the right text was on slide 21.
All right. Can you all see my screen right now?
There we go. Yes.
All right. So you should be seeing this right here. I'll highlight it for you.
Right.
So this is what exists now. And all we're doing is where it says due to, we're changing to because of. Because of that, what we've discussed today, there seemed to be some confusion, public health emergency. That means I can take advantage of this condition. And what we've been trying to say, no, it has to be due to it. That's why you couldn't fulfill the request. But that apparently wasn't clear enough. And since we were in here, to be honest, proposing other changes to the infeasibility exception, we thought it was best to address this for utmost clarity. We're going to change due to
okay, great.
Establish that any of these things, you have to show that it's a causal.
Okay, great, wonderful. Yeah, because the text, particularly as you presented today, was focused on the public health emergency side, mm-hmm. and I missed the link.
No worries. That's what we're here for. So,
That's great. Thanks.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So we're happy to support this change, right, Ike?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. Okay, good. Minor point. You know, it is fascinating. Just a philosophical observation. Not being an attorney and not having spent my life understanding how carefully reg text needs to be refined. You know, this seems like such a minor change, you know, and for some people due to and because of would seem to say exactly the same thing. But the fact that this has raised an issue, you know, in the public, people have had questions, and that making this change, you know, makes that better. It's pretty remarkable. All right, let's cut early to public comment. Thank you for raising that slide. ONC, do you guys want to recite your words?
Sure, thank you. We're going to open up our meeting for public comment. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you happen to be on the phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press star 6 to mute and unmute your line. So let's pause just for a moment to see if any members of the public raised their hand.
We had a hand up earlier. There we go. And now it's up again.
All right. Melissa, you can go ahead. You have 3 minutes.
Hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Great. So I just have 2 questions, and it's about the new condition for third party seeking modification of use. And my first question, based, you know, kind of largely off of the conversation that was had earlier, and this is also in the chat, is whether or not there should be further language tweaks to clarify that we're talking about enable the use or exchange, to make clear that we're also talking about the manner in which the data might be written to the system. And then my second question is, this particular exception has a carve out to the exception for healthcare providers, right, who are requesting use from the actor that is its business associate. And I'm just curious of whether there's been consideration about, should it be just limited to healthcare providers? What about health information networks and exchanges, for instance, that have platforms supported by developers, and they might want to use a third party to also write data to their systems, because some of those platforms, it's not just strict data exchange, there's sometimes the ability to also capture or modify data or add data. So those are my 2 questions.
Sure. I think I can address some of them. So I can't remember if I sent you this link in the chat or not, Mel, but the use, I think, in the clarity that you're seeking to ensure that includes what you were talking about, we do mean the broadest sort of definition of use. We just are using modifier modification use in order to avoid confusion between this modification use idea and the HIPAA rules defined term use. So by saying modification use, we are referring to access exchanger use. And I found the citation for that I'll drop in the chat right now.
Great. And then one of my concerns with that is for the IBR's definition of use, there isn't a proposal to change that definition. And right now, the way that use is defined, it says after there's been an access or exchange. And as an attorney, and I guess parsing words, I was just worried if the plain language of the regulation might be in conflict with how broad it's intended to be in the preamble to the proposed rule.
Okay, I see what you're saying. I'd have to go back and look more closely, but that sounds like something that could be a good comment if you think we've not made that clear enough, because we definitely do want it to be obviously as clear as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we don't see any other hands up. Were there any that came in on the phone only?
No, not seeing any other hands up, Stephen.
Oh, there's a hand. That is
Melissa.
Melissa again.
And I just have another question about infeasibility conditions and if this has been considered, and I think there will also be written comments as well, but one of the things I think happens a lot with infeasibility is when actors are cutting over to new technologies or new platforms, and it's not, you know, feasible for them to bring on new customers, or they might have to temporarily disable services. And where there's the health IT performance exception, if you already kind of have an existing contract with folks and you have SLAs in place, it's not a great exception, because the health IT performance exception anticipates that your SLAs are in place, and a lot of times they don't actually address something like a new technology or a migration to a new platform. And it's very burdensome to use infeasibility under the circumstances and in those situations. And I'm just curious if there's room in written comment in the final rule for additional infeasibility conditions that could address when we're having like a significant technology change, and that makes it infeasible to satisfy certain requests as the migration occurs.
So,
oh, go ahead.
I was going to call you Melissa, but Cassie knows it's Mel, so I will say Mel. This is Mike. And I think she's going to say what I was going to say, which is, but I was probably going to add a caveat to it. Always interested in comments. The more facts like you're doing now that you can provide, the better. The caveat I was going to offer was, and obviously we're doing a lot of rulemaking if you've looked at the unified agenda, but generally speaking, there are legal limitations on what we can finalize in a final rule based on what we've proposed, without getting into a bunch of legal mumble jumbo that everybody doesn't need to hear about here. But again, always happy to have those comments and to take under consideration.
Great, thank you, Michael.
I would like to come back to the discussion, the recommendation that Hans raised about extending the 10-day infeasibility response. I think that, you know, your proposal, Hans, of switching it to upon completion of the evaluation, that clearly, you know, raised concerns. And I can see why, because one could say that the evaluation can go on forever. But could we, as a work group, just simply try to extend it a bit? You know, if we say 10 days feels too short, and I was just reviewing some of the public chat on this, yeah, is 14 days better? Is 15 days better? Could we settle on a specific recommendation?
I think that's the hard part, because I could agree with Devin. What would that be? I'm trying to see.
It'll be 10 days if we don't comment, right?
Well, let me say a couple things on that. Again, same thing that I said to Mel, always happy to have these comments. I think you should always feel free. Anybody is always, you know, public is feel free to comment. But there's still always legal considerations as to what we can finalize in a final rule. So let me just give you an example on this one. I don't believe, I'm probably like 100% certain, we didn't say we are considering whether or not we should change the 10-day. And here's a couple options, and we'd like to hear from you. So the point why I say that is the way the APA works is the public has to have notice of the potential, what you're going to do regulatory, and so that they can comment on it, so everybody can comment on it. So again, please submit your comment. I'm just want to manage expectations a bit about how the APA works for us from a regulatory perspective. Because no one else knew that that was even open for comment. Do you understand? Like, they didn't know that that could potentially be changed. So how would they have known to comment? Like, so to point, Hans had an idea. He doesn't think it's right, but Devin doesn't necessarily agree, but she didn't know that was even proposed for change, which we didn't propose. So we're all clear. Like, that isn't a proposal in this rule. Again, though, comments are always great because we can use them to inform future proposals. And if they are somehow within context, we always talk to our, you know, general counsel. whether we're able to do something. So that's the other piece.
So I think what you're saying, Mike, just so I'm clear, is that it would be outside the scope of the task force to recommend at this point that ONC extend the 10-day infeasibility to 14 days, for example. You're saying that would not be appropriate for our task force?
So I leave that to Michael Berry to kind of talk more a little bit about what your scope is. I think you have a charge, and so that brings in different laws. Like you as a person, can still make comments outside of HITACH, right? So I'm just kind of giving that more as a public service announcement so people kind of understand. I know the regulatory process seems like it's behind a curtain and it's hard to understand it if you're not in this every day. I'm sure some of the attorneys do. Like I was going to not throw out terms like, you know, there's court cases that have defined terms like logical outgrowth, for example. Not going to, you know, spend a bunch of time talking about that term here, but just the notice requirements and everything in terms of making the public aware of what is, you know, in scope for that rulemaking. So that's kind of why I wanted to say it. But we always encourage all comments. We may not be able to act upon them in the final rule, but like I said, they're useful for potential future rulemakings. I mean, before there was a rule, there was a report to Congress on information blocking. And then we had all these listening sessions and we used all that to decide what to put in the proposed rule, right? So that's my point about comments. You may see something from experience, from your own knowledge that maybe the rule hasn't addressed and should address. So that's why I'm still encouraging comments. I just was trying to manage expectations a bit.
And on that note, Stephen, I was going to be reacting to your comment by, in the context actually of what Mike raised, is that we can still bring up to say there is a concern here, and we encourage ONC to look at that and explore opportunities to do that, because we are not in line with it, 14 days, 15 days, 30 days, some other criteria that makes it very clear that is a good trigger. So I think putting a suggestion to address that for awareness that this, these exceptions are being advanced, to look at that as well as they move forward. So I think we can do something with a directional, but not with a specific recommendation.
Got it.
This is Steve, just Eichner, just to add on that. I think that would be that concept would be consistent with some of the things we've done with past task forces. Again, not necessarily looking at a specific recommendation within the scope, within the NPRM in front of us, but looking at some general suggestions about things that might be worth considering to the future.
Great. Well, we are coming up on our time here. On the slide, you can see that this work group has two additional meetings scheduled on the 23rd and the 30th, the next two Tuesdays. We will be tackling the issues that are listed here. I really appreciate folks jumping into the spreadsheet, adding specificity from our discussion that you want us to capture, and specifically to work on particular recommendations. It sounds like, Hans, your recommendation is not going to stand, but we should consider whether we will add a comment about, you know, looking at that in future rulemaking. Ike, I think your draft recommendation was addressed, you know, through our Q&A. And then you have another recommendation in there that you started to frame. I added to it a little bit. You might see whether you're comfortable with my edits, and maybe we can bring that one forward. Having said that, I really want to thank everyone for your time and attention today. We are at the hour, and hopefully we'll see many of you at HITACH tomorrow and then back here in a week.